Susie Orman, in her book, 9 Steps to Financial Freedom, tells a story of her dad when she was only 13 years of age. Her dad owned his own business. It was really just kind of a tiny shack where he sold chicken and ribs and hamburger and hot dogs and fries and all of that sort of thing. One day, the oil that the chicken was fried in caught fire, and in a few moments, the whole place exploded into flames. And he came running out of the building, safe and unhurt, before the flames could engulf him. She and her mom arrived on the scene, and they were watching their father's business burn, when all of a sudden her dad realized that all of his money was in the cash register inside the building, and before anybody could stop him, he went running back into the inferno to get his money in the cash register. But when he arrived at the cash register, the heat had sealed the metal cash register shut, and he couldn't get the drawer open. So he grabbed the cash register and came running out with it, threw it on the ground, and when he threw it on the ground, the flesh from his arms and his chest went with it, and he was severely hurt, scalded. He had escaped the fire safely once, but not the second time. The money was that important to him that he went back in. And that was when Susie Orman said she learned that money is obviously more important than life itself. From that point on, earning money, lots of money, not only became what drove her professionally, but also became her emotional priority in life. And Susie Orman, of course, has devoted her life to money, if you know anything about her, and advising people and others on money matters. So here's the question: what drives your life? What drives my life? What are we passionate about? What would we sacrifice everything for? As Christians, life on earth should not drive our lives. We live today with our eyes on eternity, Jesus tells us. Eternal values should shape our lives, should guide our decisions. The passions of our lives should be passions that last forever. And ultimately, that means people, for people live forever. Jesus calls us to care about eternal matters, not earthly priorities, in Luke chapter 6, where we pick up our study this morning. I want you to see 3 principles in Luke chapter 6 that help us understand our eternal priorities, what drives or should drive our lives. And the first principle is this: we participate in His mission by His invitation. Participate in His mission by His invitation. Luke chapter 6, beginning in verse 12. It was at this time that He went off to the mountain to pray, and He spent the whole night in prayer to God. And when day came, this is Jesus, of course, He called His disciples to Him, chose 12 of them, whom He also named as apostles: Simon, whom He also named Peter, and Andrew His brother, and James and John, and Philip and Bartholomew, elsewhere called Nathanael, and Matthew and Thomas, James the son of Alphaeus, and Simon who was called the Zealot, Judas the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. Jesus came down with them and stood on a level place, and there was a large crowd of His disciples and a great throng of people from all Judea and Jerusalem and the coastal region of Tyre and Sidon, who had come to hear Him and to be healed of their diseases, and those who were troubled with unclean spirits were being cured, and all the people were trying to touch Him, for power was coming from Him and healing them all. We don't really know exactly which mountain Jesus ascended to pray that night. The view in this slide is from the traditional Mount of Beatitudes, looking across the plain toward other mountains that rise around the Sea of Galilee there. The plain is the location where most of the villages like Capernaum and other places where Jesus was ministering are located. Jesus began this important day, this vitally important day for his ministry. He began it by pulling an all-nighter in prayer. When was the last time you pulled an all-nighter in prayer? Jesus did. Remember that Jesus has given up the independent exercise of his attributes as God to live as a man here on earth. Now, he didn't cease to be God anytime, but he gave up the independent use of those attributes. He was living in dependence upon God, and therefore in prayer he goes to God for guidance, because Jesus had to make a very important decision the next day. He was going to choose the 12 men who would be his apostles, who would be the leaders of the movement that he was starting, which we call the Church of Jesus Christ. These men were divinely commissioned to be the leaders of the church, and he would call them into his mission. And by extension, of course, he calls all of us into his mission. It was a mission with an eternal focus. So the next morning, Jesus called the disciples to him on the mountain. A large group of followers gathered, and out of that larger group of followers, he chose 12. To be his apostles. And these men make for a very interesting crew. They were not the elite of society. They were not the rich and powerful leaders in this world. They were common men, drawn from many walks of life. They were ordinary men whom he would make extraordinary by his power. Abraham Lincoln once said, "God must have liked ordinary people because he made so many of them." 11 of the 12 were from the region of Galilee, where he is at this point. 11 of the 12. They were country boys, essentially. They were not from Jerusalem and the big city and the places down there. They were country boys. The only one not from Galilee was the traitor, Judas Iscariot, or Judas from Kerioth, which was a village near Jerusalem. Of the 11, 4 were fishermen. 1 was a wealthy but hated tax collector. 1 was from the political party of the Zealots. Peter was an optimist. Thomas was a pessimist. Bartholomew, also called Nathanael, was a skeptic. James and John were known for their passionate, explosive tempers. They're called the sons of thunder. And his choices are fascinating to me. I can just imagine Matthew, the tax collector, for example, working together with Simon the Zealot. Now you understand, the Zealots were a particular political party within Judaism of the first century that was very patriotic, extremely conservative, nationalistic, even to the right, if you will, politically, of many of the Pharisees. They were known particularly for the fact that they believed in assassinating people who cooperated with the Romans. And it would be some members of the Zealots who would lead the insurrection, the revolution later after Jesus' day, that ended up on the top of Masada. It was Zealots who were leading that revolution. And now we have the Zealot, and we have the tax collector. The tax collectors were hated because they cooperated with Rome. They made lots of money off the Jewish people by cooperating with Rome. And people like Matthew were people that the zealots would be happy to slit the throats of, literally, because they believed in assassinations. And yet you have Matthew, the tax collector, working closely together with Simon the Zealot. That's God's transforming power. That's the power of God to change lives and bring people together to serve together for Him. God calls ordinary men and women to do extraordinary things for Him. And when He calls, He equips. He makes us new. He transforms us as we follow Him. He changes you. He changes me. Oswald Chambers once said, "All through history, God has chosen and used nobodies, because their unusual dependence on Him made possible the unique display of His power and grace." Nobody's. That's who God chooses. Nobody's like you and me. Why? Because His extraordinary power to transform lives is best seen in us as He works in this world. Then Jesus led them to this level place on the mountainside to minister to the people. He calls the 12 immediately into ministry. He didn't give them some sabbatical or some time off to get ready for this. They go right into ministry that morning. It's probably the first time that these 12 men have been put in positions of leadership, assisting Jesus in a meeting, meeting the needs of the crowds that thronged around Him. And what was their first job? It was crowd management. It was managing all of this activity around Jesus. They were participating in Jesus' mission by His calling. And He is changing them. The book of Revelation tells us that when God completes His heavenly city in eternity future, the 12 foundation stones will bear the names of the 12 apostles. They were living for a kingdom they couldn't see. They were participating in a mission that has not yet ended. And they would be rewarded with an eternal reward in the kingdom of heaven. In 1882, the artist and architect Antoni Gaudi started work on his masterpiece, The Church of the Holy Family, in Barcelona, Spain. For several years, he actually lived on the building site. As the building rose skyward from its foundations, Gaudi's fame became well known, and kings and queens came to see this beautiful building, imagining what it would one day become. Then in old age, Gaudi was run over by a tram, and they thought he was so poor that they put him in the poorhouse, and some of his friends tried to come and save him and help him and get him into a hospital. He said, "No, leave me with the people that I'm a part of." And he died 2 days later. They buried him on the grounds of this cathedral. He began his work planning it in the 1880s. He was still working on it 40 years later when he died, and it was only 15 to 25% complete at that time, less than a quarter complete. Other architects have worked on a project over all these years, taking his designs and implementing them. And the towers and most of the church's structure are intended to be completed in 2026, 10 years from now. The centennial of Gaudi's birthday, or Gaudi's death, excuse me. So the project reminds us that in God's kingdom, we are all called to pour ourselves into something bigger and greater and more wonderful than any of us. We are part of something much bigger than ourselves. That is our purpose in life. An eternal kingdom, the kingdom of heaven, a kingdom that never ends. We are participating in a mission that will not end. That's our mission. And that's how we live, first of all, with an eternal perspective. Second principle, pursue heaven's goals to find true happiness. Verse 20. And turning his gaze toward his disciples, he began to say, "Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who hunger now, for you shall be satisfied. Blessed are you who weep now, for you shall laugh. Blessed are you when men hate you and ostracize you and insult you and scorn your name as evil for the sake of the Son of Man. Be glad in that day and leap for joy, for behold, your reward is great in heaven." Eternal perspective. "For in that same way their fathers used to treat the prophets." I believe this is a summary of what we have called the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7 are also a summary of the Sermon on the Mount. I say summary because in both cases, they are not a full-blown transcript of the sermon. Jesus spoke for a long time, and these are simply summaries of what he had to say. Matthew tells us that Jesus went up to a mountain to speak. That's why we call it the Sermon on the Mount. Luke tells us he came down to a level place to speak. Some people say there's a contradiction there. There really is no contradiction because the level place is on the side of a mountain. And so it's not a contradiction at all. The traditional site has a church on the top and a gently sloping hillside down to the Sea of Galilee. It's a beautiful sight. We walk down, that's some of our group right there walking down this path. We walk down a path from the Church of the Beatitudes up on the summit down to the Sea of Galilee at the down to the shoreline. There's kind of a natural amphitheater that is formed there by almost a bowl-shaped level place partway down the mountainside. Here's a picture of it you can see. Forms kind of a level place with kind of a bowl-shaped area that is partway up the mountain, and the acoustics from the Sea of Galilee really help make it sound sound can travel really well there. In fact, when we were on top of the mountain, you could hear people banging the mud off their shoes way down at the shore of the Sea of Galilee. The sound really carried. This is a very likely place where Jesus taught what is called the Sermon on the Mountain or the Sermon on the Level, whichever you like. Imagine now the disciples for just a minute, because they're seated around Jesus. The text says he started talking to them, but then he talks to the crowds. Crowds in ever enlarging, widening circles, moving outward from him as he begins to speak. And Jesus drops some real bombshells on everyone. We read these and we're kind of used to these terms, but these are huge bombshells for Jesus to be expressing. He is literally turning the value system of earth on its head. It's a whole new value system, the value system of heaven. The word blessed basically means favor of God. It can be translated happy. True happiness rests in God's favor on us. And Jesus is asking us a very important question, just as he asked them in that day, for we too are followers of Jesus. He is asking us, will you be happy with heaven's happiness or only with earth's happiness? Will you be happy with heaven's happiness or earth's happiness? What's going to drive your life? The first bombshell is that God blesses those who are poor on earth with the wealth of the kingdom of heaven. Now, God does not say that all poverty is blessed. Jesus is not saying here that all poor people are blessed by God. That's simply not true, of course. It's not poverty itself that is being blessed. He's saying happy are those who have little here but are living for kingdom goals, because they will get a reward in the kingdom of heaven. Matthew uses the expression, blessed are the poor in spirit. giving us that spiritual dynamic behind his words. He is speaking to his followers who are giving up all of their material prosperity here on earth to follow him. So we may be poor here on earth, but we are rich in the kingdom. Pursue heaven's goals. Don't live for earth's gold. Second bombshell. God blesses those who hunger now with the satisfaction that comes from his kingdom. Now, Matthew says, "Blessed are those who hunger after righteousness, for they shall be satisfied." So don't live for the hunger that can be filled with earthly food, with earthly goods. Live for the hunger that only finds fulfillment in Jesus and in his kingdom. We can be full now and empty later, or we can be empty now and full later. Which do you want? That's the value choice Jesus calls us to make in life. Third bombshell. God blesses those who weep now with laughter in heaven. Now, Jesus is not saying that we should never laugh or smile. That's not the point. Laughter is a wonderful gift from God. And we as Christians should enjoy hearty laughter despite the fact that some Christians seem to think that if you're spiritual, then you're morbid and morose and never laugh at anything, never smile. C.H. Spurgeon once said that some preachers seem to have their neckties twisted around their souls. Jesus is talking about shallow laughter, frivolous fun. We can fall into a shallow lifestyle as if we live in one of those silly sitcoms that seem to permeate television. Jesus is saying that's not the laughter that matters. Laugh full, but weep deep. Laugh full, but weep more, for God weeps for this world. Weep for the lost souls that are all around us. Weep for our country sliding deeper into the cesspool of sin. Weep. Our values should be guided by his values. And then, when that happens, one day, we will laugh with the fullness of eternal joy in the kingdom. What do you care about? Fourth bombshell. God blesses those who are hated on earth for following Jesus. And Jesus spends a whole lot of extra time on this one. We should rejoice, he says, when we are hated, ostracized, insulted, scorned. Of course, as long as we are hated for following the Son of Man and not hated for doing something bad. It's a privilege to be hated for Jesus' sake. It's a privilege to be persecuted for the name of Jesus. Laying down our lives for him is not a sacrifice, but a privilege that God calls some to carry out. We haven't faced much of that in our country, but believers elsewhere certainly have. And when we pursue heaven's goals, we will face earth's hatred. Expect it and be glad. Live for heaven, not earth. The nonprofit organization Mars One has set a goal of establishing a human colony on the planet Mars by 2027. That's only 11 years from now, 2027. They plan to send 4 pioneers as a test group and then to add another 4 volunteers every 2 years after that on Mars. These volunteers would have to be highly resourceful. They'll have to serve as the colony's chefs and farmers and doctors and engineers. But the most striking prerequisite for being one of these volunteers is you never get to come back. There's no way back. You're going to live and die on Mars. they had 200,000 video applicants. They narrowed it down through screening to 1,058, then down to 660. Now they're down to 100 in the screening process. One finalist, an emergency room doctor by the name of Leela Zucker, said, "We can't stay on this planet forever, I would argue. Let's go now." Other applicants said they viewed the mission as a way to unite humanity for one extraordinary, transcendent cause. We already have one. We already have one. I don't need to go to Mars to be a part of an extraordinary, transcendent cause, and neither do you. It's the kingdom of heaven. That's our cause. And Jesus commissions us not to go to Mars, but to build colonies here on earth. We are colonizing earth for heaven. That's our mission. And there's no way out for us either. It's live and die in this process. This is our mission until Jesus comes back. We are living on earth for heaven. And it's as simple as that. So Jesus is asking us, will we be happy with heaven's happiness or earth's happiness? Which is it? Third principle, avoid the regret of living for now. Verse 24, "But woe to you who are rich, for you are receiving your comfort in full. Woe to you who are well fed now, for you shall be hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, for you shall mourn and weep. Woe to you when all men speak well of you, for their fathers used to treat the false prophets in the same way." Students from Strayer University in New York City set up a chalkboard on the sidewalk one day, and at the top of the chalkboard was written, "Write your biggest regret." And they put colored chalk out there for people to use. So what's your biggest regret in life? Write it on this chalkboard. And they set up a camera to record people as they wrote their biggest regrets on this chalkboard. And it was soon filled up with overflowing by all the passersby on that street in New York City. "Burning bridges, not being a good husband, should have spent more time with family. Not saying I love you, not making the most of every day, not being a better friend." As the board filled up with these different stories, you notice there's a word that occurs very frequently in those regrets, and it's the word "not." It's about chances not taken, opportunities not seized, words not spoken, dreams not pursued, people not cared for, regrets. Regrets are the flip side of blessings. Each woe matches each blessing in this list. So the woes are the flip side of the blessings. In fact, woe is probably a confusing translation. The word is more of an exclamation like, "Alas," or "How terrible," "How awful." It's a regret. These are expressions of regret. So the person who lives for now will one day regret it. The person who lives for earth will one day regret that choice. Woe is me. I've lost it all. I've wasted it. Don't waste your life, Jesus says. Jesus calls us to avoid the regrets that come from living for now, for this earth, instead of eternity. Four regrets that the world squeezes us into. We pursue these things, and in the end, we will regret what we have pursued. The first regret is for those who live for material wealth. four of these regrets, these woes. Jesus points out that if we live to accumulate the wealth of this world, then we will get paid well. Now, that's our pay. Whatever we get here and now. The expression to receive comfort in full means to be paid in full. You live for the wealth of this world, whatever you build up in your little kingdom is your pay. And you might get paid well, but you can't take it with you. It's all gone one day. When all you have is the possessions of earth, you are paid in full on earth. You have it all, but you have nothing for eternity. So, in that case, live it up now. Enjoy it because you're spiritually empty and you can take nothing with you. What are you living for? Second regret is for those who live for self-satisfaction. Once again, it's not just physical, literal hunger that is here. It is the sense of self-satisfaction, self-fulfillment that comes from having all we need to eat, all we need to live, having our needs met and fulfilled. And we may be satisfied now. You can make a good life in this world, I can, and be satisfied for ourselves. But self-satisfaction will never fill our need in eternity. Never fill our lives in eternity. We will regret. We will write on that chalkboard of eternity, I regret not investing in His kingdom. Because we need to bank our investments in His kingdom so we have it, we can enjoy the fullness of life in that kingdom, your reward. Third regret is for those who live for the shallow laughter of earth. Now again, Jesus is not being a killjoy here. He's not against genuine joy. He's talking about those who spend their lives with shallow entertainment, superficial happiness, things that don't last. The happiness that many have is a happiness built on a nothing very deep. It's a laughter without any depth, any foundation. Jesus says when you fill your life with this sort of shallow entertainment lifestyle, you will mourn the loss of all of that superficial laughter in heaven because you won't have any laughter for heaven. There'd be nothing there to live for. If we laugh at nothing now, we're going to laugh at nothing in heaven. The fourth regret is for those who live for the narcotic of flattery. And it is a narcotic. It is addictive. The danger is that we live for the flattery of fools today when people speak well of us. If the world speaks well of us, if the world honors us now, it is probably because we have found ways to compromise so that people like us, so that they speak well of us. Because we're living for here and now like they are. We've become yes men and women, living for everything that everybody else lives for, seeking the applause of others now. As the saying goes, even a dead dog can swim with the tide. Watch out for the flattery of this world. It's addictive. It will destroy your desire for heaven. When we're getting the applause of earth, when we're getting the good stuff that comes from everybody's feelings about us now, it eats away at our desire for heaven. And we will come to regret that deeply. In 1914, not long after the sinking of the Titanic, actually, Congress convened a hearing to discern what happened in another maritime tragedy. In January of 1914, a thick fog off the Virginia coast, the steamship Monroe was rammed by the merchant vessel Nantucket. It eventually sank. 41 sailors lost their lives in the frigid waters of the Atlantic Ocean. Well, it was Osman Barry, captain of the Nantucket, who was arraigned in court on charges. In the course of the trial, Captain Edward Johnson was grilled on the stand for over 5 hours. He was the captain of the Monroe. And during cross-examination, it was learned that Captain Johnson navigated the Monroe with a steering compass that deviated as much as 2 degrees from the standard magnetic compass. And it had never been recalibrated. And so, because of that, and he argued on the stand that this was common, they didn't worry about it that much in the coastal shipping industry. But as a result of that, his compass being off by 2 degrees, he put himself in position for the tragedy to take place. There was a heart-rending picture recorded by the New York Times after the trial. The two captains met, clasped hands, and sobbed on each other's shoulders. These two burly seamen are a reminder of the tragic consequences of misorientation. If the heart is like a compass, what's it tuned to? Where is it focused? It better be focused to the Creator and His kingdom. Jesus is calibrating, if you will, our spiritual compasses to focus on the values of eternity. That's why you go and serve at His mansion. That's why you serve where you work and in your families. That's why you serve in the church. We're being recalibrated. Our spiritual compasses are being focused on the values of eternity. They better be oriented around heaven, not earth. Because true north for us is heaven. That's true north. And even being off a little bit, we're going to get distracted and caught up in the stuff that pulls us away from His values. Constantly recalibrate the compass of your lives. What's important to you? What are you focused on? Where is your compass pointed this week? Father, as we follow Jesus, keep us, our hearts, our minds, our thoughts, our values focused on You and Your eternal values and on heaven, that we might live as colonists on earth. In Jesus' name, amen.